Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 17th, 2019, and welcome to episode 188 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, learning from retro computing, and recently, lemons. So, I am Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by Quinn Dunkey in Los Angeles. How are you, Quinn?
Good. Hello, Internet.
The Internet waves. And Jack Nutting in Stockholm. How are you?
I'm good, Paul.
Excellent. I'm also good. I guess I didn't say that, but whatever. So hopefully we will at some point hear about the truth about the lemons. but I think for a host topic, I wanted to start talking a little bit about. I didn't ask about the weather, but that's okay.
We don't have weather in Los Angeles, so it's fine.
Right. Anyway, on our Facebook group, Jason posted a link to a book called Learn Programming Using Retro Computing. And I took a quick look at this. It seems to be essentially the idea is to possibly under emulation use a Commodore, a +4 to learn how to program as a way to sort of get into the concepts of running computers. And I thought about that and I wasn't sure if it was a good idea. We have all of us had these thoughts about how retro computers are nice because you can envision the entire operation of the thing and they're simple and that sort of thing. But I wondered. So I thought maybe that would be a thing we could talk about. I'm sure the book is fine. I don't mean to savage the book. But so I don't know. What do you think? In the notes, Quinn, you said you had some thoughts on these topics.
Yeah, honestly, I think it's a great idea if it's done. Right. I think that, I think this is suggested fairly often. And when people suggest it, I always think back to the Osborne series of computer books, which were really big in the UK and in Canada back then. And, I've talked about them a lot, in fact, on other podcasts. And what I loved about those books was sort of the audacity of them, because, of course, at the time, this was fairly cutting edge technology and that they were teaching, frankly, very young children was their target demographic. I don't know if you've seen these books, but they have, cartoons of like robots putting bits in registers and stuff. And they're fantastic. They've actually been released into the public domain. So I'll see if I can find a link to those for the show notes. But so the audacity of trying to teach, assembly language to 10-year-olds through cartoon robots, I really, really love that. And this is kind of in that same vein, I think. The secret to maybe making this work is the execution, because while the environment of programming on retro computers is very educational and very pure, the logistics of it are terrible, right? And modern kids are not going to put up with floppy disks and bad keyboards and slow load times and, having no memory for a decent editor and all those sorts of things. So if you can come up with an emulated environment, I think that might be the way to go. Now, the downside to that is, you lose the verisimilitude there. So, and once you're in an emulator, well, now you're just in another virtual machine. So how is that different from teaching someone Java or, C# or something like that? So, yeah, I don't know. There's some challenging questions there, I guess.
Yeah, I think this book, talks about using an emulator, especially because I guess they're talking about a Commodore 16 or a +4, which, those are unusual things to find anywhere. So... Yeah. I don't think I've ever even seen one in person, even back in the day. But they're talking about using an emulator, and I thought about what you were saying as you said it, and I realized that I think you're right about, like, I remember, like, the, and I still like the physical hands-on thing of this is my Atari, and I plug things into it, and there it is, and I'm using it. But I think kids today are already pretty well accustomed to the idea of using something on a computer that they know is an encapsulated thing. You know, whether they're playing, you know, they're playing Minecraft, say, or whatever, and they know that the Minecraft is not the web. And Minecraft is not the same as other games they're playing or things they're doing. So I think that kids are pretty savvy, and I think they can see this as being, okay, this represents something that is my parents' form of computing. I think they can get that. And the fact that you can do it in an emulator, and if you set it up right, again, they talk about using Vice, which I've never actually used, but if you set up Vice in a nice way with disk images and the ability to save and load things quickly and easily without a lot of hassle, then it's probably pretty decent. It's probably a decent way of being able to sit with a kid and interact with them and say, okay, this is something similar to what I did 30 years ago, that kind of thing. I don't know. I think it could work. My kids are now too old because they're teenagers. I couldn't get them to sit with me and do this, but would have been interesting to try this like 10 years ago to show them like some old computing stuff and get them going with it. Because I think as you said, as we've talked about a number of times, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think the only way it could possibly work is with emulation because, yeah, you have to have a decent editor and you have to be able to copy and paste and things like that, which you wouldn't be able to do without an emulator. But yeah, I think there's a real risk of not making that connection between the fact that this is actually real hardware and it isn't just because, you know, most other introductory programming environments are also a little black box or a little black virtual machine of some sort. You look at things like Scratch and, you know, other introductory programming environments, and there, you know, I think the child understands that, oh, I'm learning to program in this very specific and ultimately useless environment. It doesn't feel like programming the computer in the same way. I wonder, to get the effect that we're looking for, you might have better luck with something like Arduino programming or Raspberry Pi programming where there's a physical thing that you're looking at, and so you can still use a pleasant environment, but you understand that your code is going into this small, physical, limited environment that's sitting right there, and you can see it. It's not, you know, it's not an abstract concept.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It does seem like the context is quite different that the kids are approaching this from. I know that we all sort of feel like this is what sucked us into it, you know, like the ability to make this little box do stuff. And yeah. It was really sort of solving problems. There were no other ways to solve these problems, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a key. I think it's important not to retcon our own childhood experiences onto current children because, like, my 9-year-old nephew has gotten into programming, and he got there through Minecraft. You know, for him, that was a type of programming that was solving a problem that he cared about. He wanted to be able to make things dance around using, you know, Redstone or whatever, like he saw in the YouTube videos. So for us, you know, BASIC was solving a problem of, oh, I want to animate something in low-res graphics or whatever. But so for him, Minecraft was his gateway drug. And then from there, he's gotten into Python. And I think, you know, that's a great introductory environment because it is real programming, but it's also a very sort of limited and self-contained environment. I think we have to be careful about assuming our experiences are universal.
Mm-hmm. Well, plus the other thing also, and like, I'm not sure what the book is promoting specifically, but, you know, if you were going to use a Commodore 16 plus 4, you might well be using, you know, some variant of Microsoft BASIC or, you know, BASIC of some kind with all of its go-tos and all that, you know, wedging lines in between lines and stuff like this. And it does seem like it's not entirely clear that the effort that goes into that pays off in sort of later life.
Yeah, like what are you solving for there, right? Like to program on retro computer, yeah, you end up learning a lot of bad habits because you're doing weird things with basic line numbers or whatever, and you're also dealing with an environment that has a lot of very arbitrary restrictions, you know, nonlinear video memory and, you know, other strange things that you have to learn to deal with that is nowadays a useless skill and only existed back then for, you know, esoteric reasons to do with chip costs and so on. So, you know, yeah, you don't want to get bogged down in that stuff just to learn, you know, fundamental concepts of programming like data structures and, you know, that simple joy of making the computer do things. So yeah, I'm sort of talking myself out of this the more we talk about it, frankly.
Yeah, it's tricky because, I mean, the joy part is really having sort of a dedicated thing that like you turn on and go with, you know, that it's simple to make it do simple things.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times when people talk about this, the thing that they're going for is they want kids to experience the more visceral connection to the hardware, which is what we used to have. And I think, because I do think that's a legit point, that kids nowadays have completely lost that. Like, there are so many layers of software in that stack between you and the hardware that, you know, computing has become so abstract to the point where, you know, try explaining the fact that on a retro computer you have to turn it off and on again between every piece of software that you want to use, and try to even explain why that's necessary. It's a very difficult conversation. So I think trying to recreate that connection to the hardware is valuable, but there again, I think it might best be done with something like an Arduino.
Mm-hmm. Or BBC had not like a year or two ago, they released a little, you know, some little like learning computer that's kind of I don't know, Raspberry Pi like.
Or thinking of the Microbit.
Yes.
Is that it? Yeah, I have one of those. We bought a bunch at work. We had like kind of just like a fun sort of hack day to play with these things, those who wanted to, and it was interesting. It's very limited hardware. It has like, oh gosh, it has like just some simple input output pins, no real video or anything. It has some LEDs. What was it? A 3x3 or a 4? No, maybe a 5x5 grid of LEDs that you could light on and off. And it had kind of two different programming environments you could use to do with this. One was Scratch-like, and one was Python. And neither of them was a really nice environment. And the Scratch one produced really slow running code on the thing. Like, I did some tests just like of making things blink. Or not. Actually, I made a very, very simple game. It had like two buttons. I made a simple game of like, doesn't matter what it was. Anyway, I did the first in the Scratch thing, and I was like, wow, this is dog slow. And then I just plus it was I quickly realized how limiting the Scratch kind of Scratch style of environment is, because I'd never really used one for more than 5 seconds before. Once I sat and tried to make something with it, I was like, wow, this is a pain in the neck and it's super slow. So I just rewrote it in Python in a few minutes, and it was way, way faster. Anyway, so both these environments, though, like, neither of them felt like a really... It still felt pretty, like, distant somehow. It's like, yeah, I have this thing plugged in through USB port, and I'm putting my software on it, and I can see the lights light up, and it reacts to the buttons that I press, but it was... I don't know. I think you have a good point, Gwyn, but at the same time, I feel like it's still never going to be quite the same as we had with, you know, the piece of hardware that I'm typing on this piece of hardware... And then that's the thing running it. It's like the thing that I'm programming on and where the program is running are the same. That's kind of still missing from these things.
Yeah, I guess that feeling of distance might be unique to us, because to us it is distant.
Yeah.
But to, you know, someone who grew up with Minecraft, writing a line of Python code that turns on an LED in a little box plugged in with USB might feel extremely immediate, extremely connected, and might still spark that joy, you know, that we're trying to spark.
Sure. Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah. You know, in another environment that we haven't talked about yet is Lego Mindstorms. I think that's another programming environment that has a very visceral feedback. You know, you're building a robot and you're writing code on this little box, and it's immediate, and it's solving a problem that a lot of kids want to solve, which is, I want to make a robot drive around. And so that's, I think, another great option. Mm-hmm. And I think Kate Skotnicki, a KFest regular, has actually done this in her classroom. I think she has used retro computing to teach some of these concepts, but you'll have to have her on maybe and ask.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I mean, like, having a connection to the outside world like that is, I can see that being very, I mean, even now, I like that. It's very compelling. Mm-hmm. So this, I don't remember exactly how this, you know, what the state of this project is. There's this... it's an Apple II emulator called Micromate that it grew out of a project. It's sort of connected. It's connected to the people who do the Paleotronic magazine. It was, I think, originally going to be a kind of collaborative educational environment. There was a presentation, at least one, at Kansas Fest at some point about sort of how this works when it was kind of being built. And I think the idea is supposed to be that, that kids, even maybe remotely from one another, could collaboratively program and you know, communicate while driving a virtualized Apple II, which that, you know, that also seems like I can see the kind of pull there too, that there's a kind of a social aspect to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've done some very out of the box thinking on Micromate. It's, there's definitely some high concept stuff in there, and yeah, I'm also not sure what the state of it is, but it's definitely interesting what they're going for.
It might also be good for retro computing if people do this, because that will get you know, the younger generation interested in retro computers as retro computers, because mm-hmm. otherwise it's all going to disappear.
Yeah, I've actually had some success with that at work. So I'm an engineering manager, and all of the engineers, for the most part, that I manage are all, you know, in their 20s and have never even heard of half of the computers that we talk about. And so I've done presentations at work about, you know, here's how you program the high-res page on the Apple II, and here's how you, you know, do manage scanline interrupts on the Apple IIgs and those sorts of things. And they're completely riveted by it. You know, people are really fascinated at how difficult these old machines were and how complex and how arbitrary all these restrictions are and all this, and it's sort of the intellectual challenge of programming within those restrictions. So that, I think, does still have appeal at an adult level, but I don't think kids are interested in that.
Right. Like poetry.
Yeah. But, you know, modern software engineering is this sort of, it's turned into this bizarre grunt work of installing SDKs and trying to get different middleware to play nice with each other, and you spend most of your time reading documentation, and you know, it's a very different experience than it was in the 80s. And so I think adult software engineers see retro computing, you know, they see a block of 6502 do something immediate, and it's that thrill is still there for them. So the future of retro computing interest might be in 20-something software engineers who came of age in the deep tech stack cloud computing world.
Interesting.
Jack, didn't you did something, you like gave a presentation on writing a 2600 game or something, did you not at some point?
Yeah, I did. And I was just on doing it, you know, just using raw assembler and the Stella emulator. I made a very simple, this was back in the days of Flappy Bird. I made a very blocky version of Flappy Bird called Flippy Bit. It was just squares and rectangles. And like, I just kind of made this in like a funny way using the original Atari palette as an iPhone game. And then I thought, well, this is kind of fun, you know, and it was using the normal iOS technologies I was used to using. I thought, well, wait, this is also really simple. I could actually probably do this for the 2600 for real. And so I never really finished it. Like I didn't implement a score counter, and there's not really an end game. It just kind of like, it's kind of the basic game mechanics without really ever stopping. But it's only 400 bytes. And it's not, and so that was kind of neat. Like just that I was able to sort of get a lot of things to happen in a very, very small space. And that was fun. And like I've given presentations of that at work and things, and people liked it and were interested. At least somewhat. I can't say that it led to anyone I was working with who saw the presentation actually sort of picking up the thread and saying, hey, where do I get these tools? How do I start doing this? So I think people are curious, but still, I don't know. I'm probably a bit older than most people that I was working with also. And so there were a bit of this younger crowd who were kind of like, yeah. I'll go back to my Ruby environment. That's much more comfortable and friendly.
Yeah. Okay. So, in conclusion, I don't know where we are, but
yeah, well, no. We solved that problem. Okay, moving on. Next.
No, I think it is interesting to think about though, and it was fun to talk about, even though I'm not exactly sure where I land, but I can sort of see more pluses and minuses than I used to.
Yeah, probably we need an educator in this conversation at this point.
that does not seem like a bad idea. Yep. I'm hypothesizing how kids work without actually getting much of a real idea.
Where there's a lot of armchair parenting going on here.
That's right. Okay, I think I will move on to talk about listener feedback. And the first one I wanted to mention was an email that I got from Todd, which might lead off the what we might call the Carrington Correction Corner.
This is my favorite segment.
That's right. I haven't tried this myself, but Todd writes that the Quadro 630 can't, in fact, use the Apple IIe card, even though it has a processor direct slot, because at least according to the Quadro 630 manual, the machine only operates in 32-bit addressing mode, and so it doesn't support the card. So that's sad, but I think I still might try it, but I am not that optimistic anymore that it would actually work. Though the machine itself still has all the other properties that it had, and apparently it also has the same the motherboard part is the same form as the one for the Performa 6200 CD, writes Todd. So you can sort of slide them in and out to swap the brains of the machines if you wanted. So. Anyway, that was interesting. Sort of sad news about the Quadro 630 after the hard sell Carrington gave it before. Yeah,
the takeaway there is that Carrington was wrong. Let's just be clear on that point.
Yeah. And I think Quinn, you can maybe contribute your own feedback on Carrington and the lemons if you want.
Oh, the lemons! Yeah, it turns out if you make a fuss on Twitter, you get invited on the show. But the problem for me, you see, is that it's much easier to sound smart on Twitter than it is to actually come here and sound like I actually explain in detail that I know what I'm doing. I don't mean to put you on the spot.
It's all right.
Yeah. No. I anticipated the lemon conversation. I will say that there. If you do want to see people try this, because shockingly, we're not the first people to think of maybe powering a computer with lemons. There are actually YouTube videos of people trying this. So in general, you build voltage by putting potentials in series, and you build current by putting them in parallel. But there is still a power delivery limit on that, because there is a loss of efficiency when you do that. And because a lemon delivers, you know, while it's 0.7 volts of potential, building potential is actually fairly easy, right? Like static electricity is a voltage potential with no current. It's why the world doesn't run on static electricity. And in fact, it's why it's called static electricity. So you can't direct lightning into a wire and have it power something, because it's static. And
well, this is ruining Back to the Future, isn't it?
It is. So I'm about to ruin a lot of things. the Quinn Dunkey story. So with lemons, you get a decent amount of potential. In fact, you can get potential out of anything with a pH in it. So, you know, potatoes and lemons and any kind of citrus, you know, lots of things that can make voltage. So you can stack up that voltage pretty high, but when you try to get the current, because the current delivery ability of the citrus is so low, the ability for electrons to move within that medium is very, very low, you would need an enormous amount of lemons in parallel to get any kind of current out of it. You know, even to get into the milliamp range is difficult, and with each of those parallelizations, you have inefficiency that's introduced, sort of like it's the friction of the electrical world. And so you can't ever get ahead of it, basically. No matter how parallel you get, you can't. The inefficiency of the electron movement in the medium overwhelms your ability to build current. So anyway, that was a complicated explanation of why you probably can't power your Apple II on lemons.
So we can get an LED to go, maybe, but...
So you can do some things. So you can run, like everyone's seen, potato clocks, right? They are doing that because you can get a clock that runs on very, very, very low current. It's possible. So it's any circuit that can run on low enough current, you can. An LED might be tough because LEDs actually use a decent amount of current, something in the 5 milliamp range. An Apple II needs amps. So that's just never going to happen.
But we'll return to this topic somewhat in the gift idea.
Okay, I look forward to it.
Let's see. A couple other things that came across the feedback path. Tony wrote a couple of things. Tony pointed out a IEEE Consumer Electronics Hall of Fame readers selections link I guess they said that they consulted hundreds of IEEE members, and the most memorable submissions were, and then they listed a couple things, among them the Amiga 500 in the episode and HX20, and it was just sort of interesting to see, you know, when was this published? It was published not too long ago, January, I think. Yeah, end of January. So people out in the real world still thinking of these things. There's an even a longer sort of Consumer Electronics Hall of Fame that they internally picked. I don't know, somewhat interesting.
If there's a comment thread on that article, I bet it's entirely about why the Amiga wasn't a success. Everybody has theories on that, and you cannot say the word Amiga without starting a conversation about how it was all Commodore marketing's fault or whatever pet theory people have.
Let me tell you about my theory.
Okay.
No. My theory is probably the worst informed of all of them.
So let's see. Tony also wrote, did you actually have a theory?
No. Okay. Nothing anybody wants to hear. It's really, really poorly informed.
So Tony also pointed out an implementation of M4th for the Model 100. This is not new. I think actually when I looked at the GitHub repository, the last commit was like 7 years ago or something. But it's still kind of interesting. I hadn't come across it. So it's, you know, 4th is a nice, simple language. And this is a version of it that runs on the Model 100. So.
Yeah, I looked at this also. It looks pretty neat. It's I like that the author of this has written a few words describing sort of like the architecture and like the things that he had to do to improve performance and things. And it's pretty interesting. Like you said, he got the one of the core things in the 4th IN interpreter is a word called next, which apparently on 8080 Fig 4th requires 11 instructions, and he used an undocumented instruction on the 8085 CPU to get it down to 4 instructions. What the heck?
And that's what we love about retro computing.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Now explain to your kids why that's fun. I'll wait.
Yes.
Don't you guys see? He went from 11 to 4. Come on.
Okay, Grandpa. It's all going to be okay.
All right. Let's see. On Facebook, Eduardo pointed out an 8-bit guy, complete Commodore 128 restoration and board repair video, which looks from my scrubbing through the video quickly, pretty interesting. Just in the sense that it really is kind of just walking through the process. So it's not something I've ever done, but I sort of feel like my confidence would be built by watching other people do these things first.
That's a lot of what YouTube is, honestly. I've learned many things for the same way, like plumbing and things around the house. Like, oh, once you see someone do it, then you have the confidence to do it. Are you guys 8-bit guy watchers?
Not really. I've watched bits of it, but it's nothing I regularly watch.
Yeah,
I like him. His production values are high, which makes it enjoyable to watch. And he shows a lot of different things, which I like. He's primarily a Commodore person, but he has all sorts of different stuff that he shows. And he has a lot of obscure, strange hardware that he shows, which is really cool. Some of his restoration projects are hit and miss. He often attempts some things, and he's done some damage to some things, but it's still a very enjoyable show to watch.
Yeah, I think we do somewhat regularly link to videos, but I often don't get much past the scrubbing through stage.
Yep.
I have a little list, at least. Eric posted on Facebook, a couple times ago, we did a fairly elaborate discussion of like thoughts on eBay and things you can do with eBay. And Eric wrote to mention that the Mac 2 USB link that we had at one point in just like the auction lists actually led to him finding an interesting ADB to USB thing that lets you use like your Apple IIgs keyboard or whatever on a modern computer. And his advice was to actually just check outside of eBay once you know the thing exists and it's like some sort of newly produced thing. See if there's maybe an external store that could save the person who's making them some of those eBay fees. Hmm. That's kind of a good idea.
Yep.
I would love to use my 2GS keyboard on a modern computer if I could somehow get one that had an alt and function keys and things.
Right.
It's always the barrier. Modern keyboards have a few keys that you honestly can't live without anymore.
Yeah, I think the Mac, if I remember right, the Mac 2 USB one was the one that used the original Mac 128 type keyboard, and you know that's exactly the same problem. It has like half the keys you need. There's some sort of fancy overlay thing that you know. I assume you hold down some key and you get an alternate keyboard, but that might be too much trouble.
Yeah, probably. I wonder, there's probably a market, a very small one, for a keyboard that was just a strip of function keys and maybe an alt and a couple other modern ones that you could put on top of your retro keyboard, like, and then it would plug into regular USB, so it would give you those keys but still let you use your retro keyboard of choice for everything else.
That sounds like a good cool product idea.
Yeah. Patent pending. It's mine.
Okay.
Don't steal it. I'm going to sell 10 of those and be 100 air.
They have a lot of feedback here, apparently, I've noted down. Roger posted on Facebook a video. What he posted was part 4 of the Germulator 8800, and I'm not exactly sure what the etymology of that name is, but it is an Altair emulator being made in Game Maker Studio, and part 4 was just posted. The project has been going on for a little while, though. Do either of you know anything about Game Maker Studio?
A little bit, yeah. I've crossed paths with it. I work in mobile gaming for my day job, and so we build mostly in Unity, but Game Maker is sort of a lower rent competitor.
Yeah, I've heard of it, but never used it for anything at all.
So it's kind of interesting to see, you know, what goes into that. It's relatively far along as of part 4. In my notes, I wrote over the past couple of years, so it might have been a somewhat long-term project.
I do think it's interesting where there's a point where the technology gap is so large that you can emulate the old thing in almost any environment on the new thing. Like, you can build an Altair 8800 emulator in Minecraft or in Game Maker or in whatever environment you have that is Turing complete, because the performance gap is so enormous. It doesn't matter what you do, it'll still work.
And run way too fast.
Yeah, exactly.
So a couple more things. Beej wrote on Twitter, we had mentioned, I think last time was the one where we talked about what old software we were still using. And Beej mentioned that he's still using SeaMonkey, which it is an update of the Netscape Navigator suite. I'm not really sure if it actually has a historical path to the original code, but I sort of remember that time where the suite would have email and web browsing and actually an HTML editor, which is, or some sort of web editor, which is what he still uses it for.
That's pretty cool. I remember using the email client that was part of the Netscape suite of things. It had a different name, though. Thunderbird?
Yeah.
Does that sound right?
I think that's right.
Yeah, I think I think it got folded into Netscape or something, because, yeah, I remember using Thunderbird, and then it became part of Netscape Navigator or something. It became one blob of internet-related software.
Okay. I never liked... It always seemed like too many things smashed together.
Right.
Yeah.
What I mainly remember is attempting to use it as a newsreader, and it was a disaster because it was just, you know, what I think I remember is that it was kind of mixing in with email, and it was just a mess. Perhaps I wasn't really using it right, but it did really seem like I prefer to have individual programs that do all of these things.
It might be interesting to try this thing, because it's got like it has support for RSS and Atom feeds and things like that, like in a way that, I don't know, it might be interesting. I might give this thing a try.
All right. Thanks, Beej.
Woohoo!
And let's see. So Blake wrote on Twitter to... He basically just discovered that he has some older iOS devices, like a third-generation iPod Touch, and he has diligently saved all of his application files, you know, over the years, thinking that he would be able to, you know, reinstall them even if they're gone from the App Store, and has discovered that this is no longer possible with current Apple stuff.
Yeah, they've gotten increasingly draconian with that, and an undocumented feature is that they can actually remove apps from your phone remotely, which it's very rare that they do it, but they do actually have that ability. So yeah, the walls of the garden continue to get higher and thicker.
Yeah, I can imagine a situation where it might be good to emergency remove some malware.
Yeah, I think, I'm sure officially that's why they have that ability, but with great power and all that, great corruption, responsibility, yada, yada.
But I can report that Blake was highly unhappy about that.
I can imagine.
So there are some third-party things you can do. I have one called iMazing, and I think Blake had some success with this, which is basically just not using iTunes, but somewhat treating your iOS device like a file system. But
And someone was talking about using some Apple developer tool that was supposed to work also that should let you move apps onto your phone. I think it was called Application Loader, which is something that I've used to upload apps to the App Store when Xcode was being goofy for some reason and failed to upload things. You use Application Loader to upload to the App Store. I didn't realize it had functionality for putting things onto a device also. But
well, there was a brief window of time where it did, but you'd have to find an old version of it. It no longer exists. It's been rolled into Xcode, so you'd have to find an old version of it, and then you have the problem of you need an old Mac because Macs won't run old Apple software either. So now you're in this recursive loop of trying to find old things to work. And the problem, of course, with iOS devices is provisioning. You know, it has they've closed the loop on the certificates and provisioning and all that. So even if you can load the binary, it may not launch because it has an invalid or outdated certificate, and you cannot create a new certificate for that device anymore and on that iOS version because they've deprecated it. So, yeah, the claws are tight. But, I think the one avenue you have for old iOS devices, which I'm sure will be the retro devices of our children, is jailbreaking. Right. You know, once you've done that, now you can do things like disable the call home that, you know, it's doing on launch to, you know, validate your certificates. And basically that opens the door to doing all of this stuff. So once you have, if you have the binary, it is possible to load it on a jailbroken device and just run it as if your phone is a computer. But yeah, that's certainly a pretty high barrier to entry. And in fact, that only works up to maybe 2010, something like that. After that, basically all apps are, you know, thin clients that are running RESTful state machines. So they're going to be useless without the servers once those all go down. Like, for example, the company I work for, every product that we build won't even boot without full internet access. So that's going to be a whole other problem for our children to solve.
Yeah.
Good thing our children will be very smart.
Yes, much smarter than us.
They will solve the problems we leave for them.
Yeah. I'm sure we can count on that.
Yeah. That I mean, it wasn't so long ago that preserving copy-protected software seemed impossible, and now, you know, we're all just doing it like it's nothing. So,
I think I'll stop there. I'm going to use the last bit of feedback as a item of interest. So, thanks everybody for the feedback, and now we can move to the greatly distinct items of interest and news. And Jack, you can start. Oh, and this one actually came from feedback too. You can start with that.
Yeah. So, yeah, just segueing from feedback to news, we got this one from Scott on Facebook. He mentioned the thing called Bassoon Tracker, which is recently released version 0.3.0. And this is a sort of Amiga mod tracker style piece of software. It's actually compatible with Fast Tracker 2, which came later than the Amiga tracker stuff on DOS. And anyway, it runs in a browser. It's pretty cool. I tried it a little bit. My tracker skills are very rusty and old, but it seemed to work. And so, like, on the whole thing with the Amiga tracker thing was it was a nice way of giving you a kind of a step sequencer that would let you put little samples on all four channels playing at once and, like, It's pretty neat. And I remember playing around with this a fair amount back in college. I remember the one I used it would give you 8 tracks. It must have just been like flipping each track back and forth between two samples, thereby making the sound even half as good as it was. But 8 tracks still, come on. It was called Octamed. Anyway, Fast Tracker came out then for DOS later. And that's like kind of the standard thing that a lot of people started using. And it has like, I don't know, way more channels and sounds. And I just bit my tongue. Like, I actually literally bit my tongue.
Ouch.
Sorry.
Ow. Darn you tongue. Or darn you teeth. Okay.
You'd think we'd have evolved out of that by now.
Somebody ought to fix this thing. Fix this mouth. No, anyway, so apart from just having samples to play at different pitches, it has the whole attack, decay, sustain, release things. You can make things sound more like real instruments. Anyway, it's pretty neat. It runs in a browser and you can sort of load files from something. It has some kind of like way you can load files from existing sources online, or you can upload them from your computer. You can take things you're working on and save them to your computer. Like, all in all, it's pretty neat. And this is something that for a long time, I wished I could find some good Mac software that was tracker-like. And sure, it's not a Mac app, but it runs in a browser, so I can use it. So I might have to give this a shot and see if I can do something fun with it.
That's actually really cool. It's certainly, we can add that to the pile of things that are difficult to explain to your children, because like music trackers as a format and as a tool are very interesting, but they're solving a very specific problem, you know, a very specific type of resource limitation in the hardware upon which they were born. Mm-hmm. And that limitation is long, long gone. So trying to explain to someone why it was necessary to basically write a high-level language form of code to play your music instead of just playing sound is, that would be an interesting conversation.
Yep.
I mean, I suppose some electronic music is still composed in somewhat of a similar environment. You know, you're looping samples and you have tracks and so on, but, yep. But yeah, certainly you wouldn't need the tool to listen to it.
Right. Yeah, actually, I forget what it was, but a guy that I used to work with, he showed me that he was using some very modern tool that had multiple ways of doing your music, but one way was a step sequencer, very much modeled after how trackers work, with kind of this vertical format. I forget what it was. I can look it up. But yeah, so there are modern approaches that modern software that has this kind of style of at least entering your notes and that sort of thing, and viewing your notes even. But yeah, for someone who's just like, hey, I'm gonna record some guitar, or you know, record myself playing piano or singing a song. Like, this seems totally, this is so far removed from what you're trying to do. It's again, yeah, not really solving the problem that a person today has with making music.
Well, I think it's interesting that you needed the tool to listen to it. You know, it's sort of like you needed the source code to run the program. Like, you're listening to the source code directly as opposed to sort of exporting it as a binary, which would be the, you know, the actual MP3 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's weird that you needed the special tool, that the song itself was just this little file that doesn't do anything by itself.
Right.
But they were so small compared to
exactly, you
know, actual samples. So
it was something audio chip memory. You don't understand kids today.
Yeah. As I recall, the Mac was a pretty poor platform for mod stuff. Mm. And it was, I think there were only a couple. There was a program that a player that I used to use that had the icon was a tractor. That's all I sort of remember. And there was a somewhat more advanced creator called, I think, Player Pro, which, you know, for the entire duration of its actual sort of useful life was too expensive for me to bother with. It was an interesting kind of society, though, or whatever, that was built around these. Mm. It felt a little bit like, you know, I guess the demo scene or the, you know, Wares scenes or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, I think you touched on something there, which is that the Mac, the early Macs were very much a sort of a bridge to what audio would become on computers, which is just that it would just all get abstracted away and you can just play any sound. But, you know, again, back to our conversation about being close to the hardware, you know, trackers were sort of a software layer for a very specific hardware implementation of producing audio, which was, you know, a parallel array of oscillators. And if that's your environment or if that's your hardware, you need a very specialized form of software to sit on top of that. But once that's no longer your hardware, once your hardware is just abstracted away to play all audio, then the software ceases to have any meaning. And in fact, it's very hard to explain to anybody. What do you mean your computer can't just play sound? It's like, well, there was 16 oscillators and you could use two at a time. And then there was a noise generator. And yeah.
Back in my day, just, you know, touched a memory location and it clicked. That's all you got.
Exactly. Yeah, kids today and their voices and oscillators.
All right. The next thing, this came to us via feedback from Marty and Carrington, but also the rest of the internet.
Yeah, I got this one while we're recording from an unrelated friend.
Right. I actually don't know who this person is, John Pfaff. He has written a book called Locked In. The story is that he got an Apple IIe out of his parents' attic and set it up and sort of had, did a little photo essay of like trying it out and discovering, restoring saved games and trying to figure out like what he was doing 30 years ago at this step in the game, you know, trying out some of the old things and showing off some of the disc labels that his father typed up for all the floppies and things. And I think, you know, in a sense, all of these things look like, this is, I see this in my office all the time, but it is, it's notable in that it's so public and it's a wonderful amount of wonder. You know, it's like, oh, the thinking about what it's going to look like to the kids, things like that. Did you read the whole thread?
Yeah, these news cycles are like a little wormhole opening from the normal world into the retro computing world. Because every so often someone famous will rediscover whatever their old computer, and then all of their followers who don't know we exist remember that old computers existed, and then the comment threads fill up with all of the nostalgia, and it's all delightful. And then it's over, and that's the end of it. I actually had some firsthand experience with this because one of my blog posts went viral in this same way. So it was sort of a simulacra of this because people thought I was one of these people. In fact, so people thought that my post was an isolated one-off of, oh, I found this old computer in the basement and fired it up for the first time in 30 years. And that for no good reason, that post went viral and exploded across the internet, and everybody got all the facts wrong, and nobody had any idea that actually I'm a retro computing enthusiast and I do this all the time. But it became one of these stories. It was a very surreal experience.
Yeah. It is pretty interesting, actually, kind of reading through the, like, skimming over the comments. I'm always a little cautious about skimming over comments, but still. There's actually quite a lot of content in that as well in the replies.
Yeah, retro computing comment threads in the mainstream are usually quite pleasant. Like, it's usually just people remembering Lode Runner and, you know, Jumpman and whatever.
Excellent. All right, and we can now move on to Quinn. You have something, I don't know how to read this, so please explain.
Yes, it's a lot of characters in a string.
I wanted, what this is. All right.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the F-18A because I feel like it doesn't get enough love in the retro computing world, and there's been maybe recent updates, I don't know. So for anyone who doesn't know, the F-18A is a standalone graphics card, basically. It's designed as a drop-in replacement for any machines that used a specific Yamaha graphics chip, which if I was smart, I would have had that at hand. It's a drop-in replacement for the Yamaha 9918 VDP, which was the graphics chip used in the TI-99-4A, which is where it gets its name. It was used in the Coleco Atom, some arcade machines, and it's quite a nice graphics chip. Similar, I would say, in capability to somewhere between the NES and the Super Nintendo. So it's got layers of sprites and tile backgrounds, and it does some font stuff. And so this F-18A is sort of a beefed up version of that. It does a little bit more. It's got more resolutions, more color palettes, and it also outputs VGA. And what's nice about it is that it's completely standalone. So in addition to being a drop-in replacement for this video chip, if you want to... So people use them to, you know, upgrade their TI-99s and things like that. But if you want to, for example, build a retro computer, this thing is a turnkey solution for generating video, which, as I found out the hard way on my Veronica project, we think of retro computers as being collections of, you know, we talk about CPUs and RAM and buses and things, but what they all actually were was some sort of video generation solution with, you know, accessories around it. That's actually the hard part, and that's why they're all different, is because they all solve that video problem in a different way. So if you want to build a retro computer, this thing does the hard part for you, and then you can just play with the CPU and the RAM and sort of the fun parts. This thing came out a long time ago. It came out in 2012, and I bought one immediately because it was super cool. It was $75, I think, which for, you know, a custom PCB and a custom FPGA is pretty reasonable. And it has sat in a box in my closet ever since. I haven't gotten around to using it for anything yet, but I really want to get it to do stuff. But I waited so long that a Mark II of it is nearing release, I think. So the new version is smaller, so it will fit in some of the smaller retro computers. Apparently, the Mark I doesn't easily fit into the Coleco Atom because of physical space limits. So this new one is smaller. It'll fit in more places. It's actually the same footprint as the chip that it's replacing, so you can put it anywhere. And it has HDMI now, which is very exciting. Unfortunately, I couldn't determine the status of it because, so on his own blog, he lists that it's in the prototype stage and it's supposed to come out in, it was supposed to come out in July. This was posted in June. There's been nothing, no information since on his blog. And he links to an Atari Age thread where he's going to be posting updates and the link doesn't go anywhere. I searched on Atari Age for conversations about it, and there is an ongoing, there's an F18A thread on Atari Age, but it does, there's no mention of the Mark II, so I have no idea what the status of it is, but if and when the Mark II comes out, I'll probably buy that and put it in my closet for 6 years.
Keep the other one company.
Yeah, I've been living the advice that we always talk about on the show, which is when these things are made, you got to buy them because they're going to stop being made forever at any point. And this is, like I say, it's if you've ever tried to build a retro computer, you understand the magnificence of this device and the problem that it is solving for you. And so that was too good to pass up, but I didn't have an immediate need for it. I just bought it because I was afraid I wouldn't be able to. And after this, so yeah, I'm sure the same will happen when the Mark II comes out.
So I'm pretty sure that this is the same chip that was on like some sprite cards and things that you could get for the Apple
yes.
II.
Yeah, I buried the lead there. So yeah, there was an Apple II sprite card whose name escapes me. I actually tried to find one on eBay before the show and couldn't. But yeah, Peter Neubauer did a presentation on that device at Kansas Fest 1 year. It was an underappreciated presentation, I think, because it was great. And there were some graphics libraries that went with that card. And the cool thing is the graphics libraries on that card will work with the F18A, so which was what Peter was demonstrating. So, yeah, it is possible to you can actually – the creator of the F18A has also designed an Apple II adapter for it, so you can put it in an Apple II. And it's just a simple adapter that lets you put it in a slot and then talk to it. So you have a separate monitor. It's not like a new video card for your Apple II. It's like a separate, completely separate device that needs its own monitor and everything. But it's a neat thing that you can do. And it's kind of amazing that the libraries written for that sprite card in the 80s work with this modern device because it was both, they were both based on the same Yamaha chip.
It's actually very cool. I found a video showing a ColecoVision with and without the upgrade. Mm-hmm. And just with the upgrade, well, it just looks way better.
Yeah.
Like they didn't change the software at all. It's just using the existing games as they were, but it produces much cleaner and better output, clearly.
Yeah, and the nice thing about this guy is that, so you can go and you can still buy the 9918A chips on eBay. They don't make them anymore, but you can buy the chips. But the chip by itself is not that useful because it outputs an RGB video signal, but you have to, it's not a video standard, it's just RGB data. So you have to then wrap that with some kind of an RGB circuit or an HDMI circuit, and you got to do all the syncing and everything yourself. So, and all of that stuff is, a lot of that is the hardest part. So it's providing, the sprite generator and the video memory and so on, but it doesn't solve the actual video part. So the F18A is all of that in one little package. So you just give it power and VGA or HDMI comes out the other end, and you've got data lines that you can configure sprites and do stuff. So, and because it's all on the hardware, if you had this in your Apple II, you could do, really fast, cool graphics on an Apple II without having to burden the CPU at all, or frankly, any other retro computer.
Yeah, and the hope I had when I was seeing it be presented was that because it's relying on something that's newly created, there might be a chance of getting one, because the actual old sprite cards are very, very, hard to find.
Yeah, for sure. You can definitely buy these F18As with the Apple II adapter. I believe he's still selling them, the Mark I's. It's one of those things where you would buy this card, though, and put it in, and you'd write some software for it, and you wouldn't be able to share that with anybody.
Right.
Nobody else is going to have this obscure configuration. So it makes for a great, KFest demo or whatever. But you're sort of screaming into the void with whatever you write on such a platform.
Yeah, though the market wasn't that big anyway.
Yeah.
The next thing, this actually just came up quite recently on the Apple II Slack, and let me begin here. So Tom Green was doing some imaging of some of his Apple II software, and has been sort of collecting things by this company called Ala Software. This software is terrible software. It is unbelievably bad. You have to see it in order to understand how terrible this is. The thing is, they actually come in fairly nice boxes. They have fairly good, you know, art on the front, and inside there's just generally a floppy disk, no instructions, with like a little typewritten label on it, and I think the titles are all, you know, they all sound sort of like something Android Wipeout or Billings and Collections or Company Purchase Manager, but they're just strikingly ridiculous. I mean, they're like they were written by someone in junior high in an afternoon.
Yes, they all look like that. Yeah. They all look like kid projects.
Yeah. And so I don't have as many as Tom has. I have a few of these. And there's actually also another company. So if you look at the sort of loading pages, a lot of them say copyright 1983, General Masters Corp. And they're almost all General Masters, and they're almost all 1983. And there's a subsidiary of KTEL called KTEC that also has, you know, nearly indistinguishable kind of software titles. And so there was we were sort of looking around, and Tom had located a couple of court cases that involved General Masters. And there's also a Reddit post that said, so someone had asked on, where was this, at the Apple II subreddit, someone asked about any information about General Masters, and somebody in a comment said, I actually wrote games for General Masters. They would have titles and brief descriptions, and we'd pay $300 for each one he did. So I think I ended up writing 10 or so. They sucked. I believed at the time, and still do, that it was some kind of tax write-off for the entertainment company that owned them. And
I guess when you're paying $300 to a developer, you're going to get what you pay for.
Yeah. But if you're in, you know, seventh grade or whatever, it seems like pretty good for a weekend.
Sure.
Yeah, totally. I would have been all over that.
I still would.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Quite a lot of these were created with kind of like a game making engine called the Arcade Machine that Broderbund put out. Yeah. So some of them actually seemed like they were, you know, they were sort of playable games, but that was because Broderbund did all the work.
Nah.
But the court cases are kind of interesting. So it essentially what it did turn out to be is some kind of like tax dodge. Like the people, the Marks, I guess, would basically invest in the software title, and then the separate company would you know, say they were going to sell them, and at a certain point, once they've sold enough of them, then, you know, the profits would come in. I think most people's reported profits ended up being kind of like, you know, $5, $30, things like this. But the court cases that you can see are all like people being taken to tax court for basically, because the software was. There were sort of two parts to this scam. One was that they were, you know, going to supposedly be getting profits, but also the software was hugely overvalued, so they could use this to write off taxes. And so it's actually kind of interesting to go through the court cases and the description. So let's see. Century Concepts Inc. is the sort of over the company that's kind of running the whole thing. And so it says in one of these court decisions. Century Concepts Inc. Was ostensibly in the business of leasing master computer video games from which the lessee could reproduce copies and offer such copies for sale to retail establishments, either directly or through a distributor. So it was essentially, so Century Concepts acquired low-quality master video games manufactured by General Masters Corp. of Los Angeles that were not designed for commercial use. And
I'll say.
But anyway, so a couple of these, it is sort of interesting. Like one of the court decisions went against someone who was basically just using this as a tax write-off. this was, well, it doesn't matter. We can follow the links. Another one was, it seems like sort of a sad story. It seems like essentially the people who are, they also didn't succeed. They also owed a lot of taxes. But it seemed like they were the ones who were duped initially. Like they thought they were going to get profits and didn't work out. So it turned into actually much more interesting of a story than I thought it was going to be. You know, like I thought this is just like crazy, terrible software, but it turned out that there's kind of a reason. You know, it looks just good enough that, you know, the packaging looks good. And if you start it, it has a title screen that looks like something. And that's probably all anyone ever saw until everybody started archiving them.
So they just needed a product that existed in this very hot market that was showing a lot of activity with high profit margins. And it looked enough like those real packages that outside observers who aren't familiar with computer software wouldn't know the difference. It looks like every other piece of software must be real. And then they could use that product to wrap various lies about profits and losses and costs and so on. Interesting.
I will say I really like the names of a lot of these games.
Yeah, like, they look like they were algorithmically generated.
Like, I just really want to play a game called Vulture Watch. You know?
Yeah.
And Phantom Munchers? Yeah. Come on. Phantom Munchers? Yeah. Who doesn't love Phantom Munchers?
And all the business software has very sort of generic sounding, like someone just rolled dice in a business thesaurus. Mm.
Like Market Chart Factor.
Yeah.
Classic.
My finance planner, things like this.
Monolithic Laser. And some of it's educational software too. So they have Multiply Ease. I'm looking at the title screen and it's kind of funny because it looks like there was a lack of planning in how to space this out, and so it kind of squishes up against the right side of the screen.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, now I have a project idea, because I honestly bet you could algorithmically generate both the titles of these things and the games themselves, because they're so simple and so poorly done. Yeah. I honestly bet you could procedurally generate Apple II software to this level of quality.
Would be pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'll add that to my project list.
I'm trying to remember, Merlin's Castle, I think it was called. I have one of the K-Tech software things, which, you know, before I knew the story about this, you know, I was just marveling at the ridiculousness of it. It's an adventure game. It's got to have like two or three rooms total. And pretty much the solution is given in the manual. it's hard to imagine anybody could have been happy with this at all, but it's funny, but you do see them out there. I mean, so if you look on eBay, you can see, you know, people are selling these things as if they were rare software, and they are rare, but this is really pushing the definition, I guess, of interesting.
Just further evidence that rare does not equal valuable.
Yeah.
They are independent variables.
All right, I think that we can move on out of the news portion to there's actually kind of an increasing list of upcoming shows and stuff like that that are happening. So Tony wrote over email pointing out that the Computer Conservation Society has a lecture series that are bringing in people that are talking about sort of computer history and stuff. They have a series in both Manchester and in London. So if you're near either of those, you can check those out. And I think we talked about many of these other, the Retro Gathering, VCF Pacific Northwest and VCF East coming up. Coco Fest is coming up. I don't know if we announced that. It is at the pretty much same time as VCF East. So you can either go to VCF East in New Jersey or Coco Fest in Illinois. And we got a recent, right before recording, basically, a big slew of Australian, mostly Apple II meetings. So the big one is the Great Australian Retro Technology Festival, which you can, if you stand far enough away, can be acronymized as GORF.
squint a little.
Yeah. But that's actually a multi-day thing, kind of on the model of Kansas Fest in Melbourne, April 24th to 28th. And then simultaneous to that, not through all the days, but on April 27th, there is a WASFest 12 o'clock happening in Sydney, and a QFest 12 happening in Brisbane. And I'm assuming they will all be video connected at that point as well.
It was sort of funny last night I went to bed and there were no known Australian Apple II conventions, and then this morning there were three scheduled. I'm not sure what happened over there.
It's pretty cool though. In the major cities, there will be one near you, so if you are there. Yeah, the other ones, the Fujiyama 2019 thing, I think we talked about also. That's another KFest-like extended thing as well.
1 week of Atari 8-bit fun.
Yep. Oh, yes, you're reading the link.
Yes, it's right there in the link. So you know.
All right. I think with that, we can go to a word from our sponsor.
It's a Radio Shack Merry Christmas. This Christmas, Radio Shack's best-selling portable computer, the Tandy 102, is a better gift than ever. It has five built-in programs, and now it's slimmer and lighter and on sale for only $399. Save $100. So when you give the Tandy 102, you've got Christmas in the desk, in the briefcase, or in the bag. Tandy Portable Computer, sale priced from $399, only at Radio Shack.
And we're back. So for the host's retro computing gift idea this time, I am going to suggest something that I've seen little bits about. I don't have any direct experience with this, but this is the Makey Makey Classic kit, which is a $50 kit that allows you to basically connect. I think it's just anything that can, like a lemon, produce voltage. So you can turn a lemon or bananas or a potato or whatever into like a gamepad controller or something. Have any of you seen these before?
I have seen them. I haven't had my hands on one, but I have one foot in this sphere of maker-related products. This is one of a family of products that are trying to be the thing that bridges stuff to other stuff. It's kind of hard to explain, but there's this whole category of products that are basically, at the end of the day, just switches. Yeah. But they have various elaborate infrastructure around them, tech stacks and web browsers and communities and apps and things. But at the end of the day, they allow you to turn one thing on with another. And they are all branded in some way similar to this to try and be the thing that kids who like to build stuff can use. And there's no real breakaways in this space yet. But here's another one.
There's a certain ridiculousness to, you know, the idea of building things with a banana and stuff like that.
So. this one has a kind of a fun, visceral take on the problem, which is, I think, kind of fun. Yeah. And the name of it is SEO Gold. I'm sure that's not an accident.
Right. Someone did a YouTube video of playing Skyrim with this like very complicated cut, you know, potato cut into various little discs and. you know, I mean, because you can, I guess, is basically the answer to these.
But. Yeah, and this one went viral a little while back, and there's videos of people making, you know, electronic music using bananas for sliders and various other funny things. So, this is definitely a fun one.
Cool. Actually, for some reason, I had this very strange, mental leap when you mentioned bananas and sliders and things. Have any of you seen, what is this called, the automaton? It is a weird musical instrument that is shaped like a musical note, like an eighth note or something. And it's by this Japanese inventor. And it essentially has this little face on it.
Oh, this thing. Yeah, I've seen videos with it. It's like, what is that?
They're very, very funny. I mean, like, it's not really retro computing at all, but it did remind me of the kind of thing you could do with a slider on a banana. But yeah, there's just something. I mean, like, it's whatever, Japanese cute, right?
Right.
I had never seen this before.
Very, very funny.
Okay.
Anyway, so anyone can look up automaton. I have one here.
Of course you do.
Can you play us a song, Paul?
You don't want to hear that. it's not simple to make it sound good, but part of the thing is it's got a the case on it is you know, it's sort of, it's shaped like a face, but you can also sort of open it and close it, you know, so that it makes sort of vocal-like sounds. So
basically, you can make tones and then adjust the mouth, kind of like a trumpet player with a baffle on the trumpet, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. I'm waiting for the next great jazz automaton band.
Right. I'm pretty sure that this the inventor who was responsible for this was also responsible for like the robot that feeds you tomatoes when you run. Anyway. All very delightful.
Good.
Okay. Well, now we can turn to eBay auctions. Jack, you have the first one.
Yeah, so I've got one here. This is, y'all know Choplifter, right? Everyone knows Choplifter. Classic game.
I've heard of it, I think. Yeah.
Classic game on every platform. Well, someone is selling a version of Choplifter for the Atari 7800 video game system, which was the very, not very popular and far too late follow-up to the 2600. So this version, it's apparently the rare 1987 version that glitches out on a lot of machines. So apparently the 7800 hardware, there are different machines made at different times, at different factories in different countries, and so there's some variation in what they have inside of them. And this particular cartridge that was produced works fine on some machines and gets glitchy and weird on others. And for the pleasure of this, the seller is asking $20.
Yeah,
but he does to his credit, his or her credit, they do include a link to an article explaining what the glitch is, which contains a short video showing the glitch, and so you can see what you're getting yourself into before buying this. Like, to me, I don't know, I have this game, and on my system it works. Like, I guess I don't know if I have the rare 87 one. I probably don't, but I mean, for me, the game itself, the normal game on the 7800 is great. Like, I don't see why I would want to have one specifically that I could buy that might not work properly on my hardware. Like,
yeah, and that's the selling point.
Yeah.
So I have some incidental contact with retro console game collectors, and I will say that they will be interested in this. Yeah. There's the really serious people are into the variants. And,
sure.
So yeah, people will pay thousands of dollars for the one edition of Super Mario that had the blue font on the back of the box or right. Whatever. It's a little silly.
Yeah, completists will want to have this, but
yeah.
Most people won't.
Now, I do have to correct one thing you said there. You described Choplifter as a classic game on every platform. It was, in fact, a classic game on the Apple II, and there's a lot of bad ports of it.
Fair enough.
Just get that on the record.
It was one of the sort of amazing technical accomplishments. I mean, like it really looked very good compared to other things that were out at the time.
It's true.
Yeah. It was one of the early games, I think, that took advantage of or worked with the limitations of, you know, of the Apple II. So the fact that it's impossible to not have a black background and do anything useful, for example, so the game takes place at night, and you know, it's all those little things are extremely well executed, so you don't notice the limitations. It just feels like it's supposed to be that way.
Yep. Just fits.
All right, let's see. So I have a large pile of things. The first one, I thought this was actually tempting, almost. The first one is an Apple IIe card, like what was mentioned before is not working in the Quadra 630. So this is the Apple IIe on a board that you can stick inside an LC or related Mac computers that basically just, you know, it's a coprocessor, separate little IIe that you can run. And the thing is that these cards, just like everything of that time period that Apple made, pretty much, has capacitors that are going to leak. And this is sad to me. I have a couple of these cards, and I have many Macs, and I have not addressed any of the capacitors, and I increasingly get worried about this. So what's being sold on eBay is one of these cards that has been recapped. So it doesn't come with the cable that lets you plug in a disk drive and a joystick, but it does, you know, it does have a functional card. But anyway, the point is it's $70, buy it now, which is not crazy expensive for something that has been fixed already. So you don't have to buy this and then worry about someday fixing it. There are seven available. So I think if you were looking for one of these, this is not a bad option. And in fact, even though I have a couple that I have not fixed, it is tempting to have at least one that will survive my not getting around to fixing them. No comment. I guess there's probably not much to say. But okay, the next thing I have, I don't know what to think about this, but so someone is selling a bunch of, actually, the seller has a bunch of these, but it is an Apple eMac computer cat bed. So it is basically the shell of an eMac in which a pillow is placed.
I'm looking at the pictures. Is it actually the computer that they've converted into a cat bed, or was it a promotional item? I don't understand what I'm seeing here.
I am pretty sure that it is. I had assumed that it was basically just the outside of an actual eMac.
It does say it was converted from an authentic Apple eMac computer.
Ah, okay. Okay, so they bought a bunch of them and then ripped out the guts and made cat beds. Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is about these, this is from a time when there were a lot of these. I mean, there's no shortage of eMacs, really. So I don't feel too bad about what's happened to this one. But at the same time, I don't know. I'm a little conflicted. I don't think I would do it myself, but if someone else did it, it's like hamburgers, right?
Right. I think one thing I really like about this is in the seller notes, the small quoted line, it says, quote, converted eMac in good condition.
Yeah. Works.
Yeah. Works. Yes.
Works as cat bed, yes. Yeah.
Well, there's actually even a photo of it working.
Yes.
And it looks like it comes in all different pillow patterns. The related auctions show all different ones you can get. So, yeah.
I wonder if there actually are all of these, or whether whether these are built to order, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder if the person is making the pillow that goes in it, or if the person is just buying cheap pillows and packaging them up and adding a margin.
Well, it does say also custom-made washable cushion. Oh, so maybe that is like that's their whole business. They're making cushions to fit into this like giant truckload of eMac shells they have.
Yeah. Yeah, this is reminiscent of when people were making aquariums out of old Macs. Mm.
Yeah, I wonder how stable that is, because the other thing too is that I think a lot of the weight of the eMac is up in the front. Mm-hmm. But if your poor cat, you know, gets in there and sort of gets toward the back, I wonder if the whole thing rolls back. Anyway, so
the trick is it's only compatible with certain types of cats from a certain range right. of the 90s, and yeah, it's very complicated. Each bed has different set of features, and nobody understands them. It's horrible.
All right, let's see the next thing. I'm not sure if this is interesting. I think it might be. I don't know. I put it in my list, so I'll talk about it. But it is a stealth serial port. I guess this is all very Mac focused so far, but it is a serial port that you can put in your blue and white Power Mac G3 in place of a modem. So what it allows you to do is get a port in there that you didn't otherwise have that would let you plug in, you know, your older peripherals, local talk stuff. When you upgrade to the Power Mac G3, mm-hmm. So it's sort of an interesting thing. I mean, it's a $50 starting bid, which may be more than I'm ready for, but
that's a pretty obscure item, I have to say.
Yeah.
I feel like this might be the Choplifter 7800 glitch edition of retro Mac collecting.
Right. Well, yeah, I don't know. What's local talk? Maybe the local talk is interesting. I don't know. I don't remember the deal with the blue and white G3, but the flat beige Power Mac G3, I think, is one of the ones that the last ones that sort of had both connections like Ethernet and local talk, and you can sort of use it as a relatively decent bridge.
I suppose if you have one of these G3s and you wanted to get some software off of it, this might be one of the ways to do that.
It is a way one could go.
Yes, like if the drives are dead and you have no other way to, I don't know. I'm trying to throw you a bone here, Paul.
Right. Thanks. Okay. Then I'll just keep going through the list. There's a seller on eBay called BayBob60 who somewhat regularly has this kind of auction. I thought it was sort of interesting and not super expensive. If you're not really into collecting and you're just sort of interested in a couple of minor little artifacts. He's collected together just a couple of things, you know, so it's a disk 2 sleeve and an unused label for an Apple II disk and an Apple III disk and some, like a notepad from the Apple II group. This is a person who was an Apple employee and, you know, sort of saved a bunch of stuff and is sort of piecing out some of it at various points. But so if you're interested, this is, he's, you know, selling it for $10, buy it now. So it's not super expensive, and it is, you know, some of that stuff is kind of, it's kind of interesting to have an unapplied disk label and that kind of thing. Like, I don't think I've ever seen in like the public sphere a diskware disk label without having already been applied to a disk.
Yeah, those are actually pretty cool. I have to say, you don't often see the old Apple II, usually like the retro or Apple logo lots. It's all old Mac stuff. So it's neat to see the actual Apple II stuff. Mm. That disk II envelope might be useful if you've, you know, if you're collecting all the original diskwares or something and the envelopes are often missing.
Mm-hmm. So pretty cool. And even if that one's gone, you can keep an eye on that seller because he's been unloading stuff for a while. This one, I don't know what to make of this, so I will put it out here. It's sold as a Tandy 102 portable computer in original box, but it actually comes with a bunch of other stuff, and it's the other stuff that I think is possibly more interesting. I mean, the Tandy 102 is also interesting, and it's still got a price tag on it, which says $499.00 from Radio Shack.
So is this a slight step up from the M100 we were talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit thinner, mm-hmm. And I think that's the main thing, is it's just a thinner thing, but it's otherwise compatible.
Probably run that M4th on here.
That's true. About. It comes with, first of all, a cassette recorder, the original box, that's cool. There's some kind of keypad. It's not clear what it is. It has, you know, the number keys, and then yes, no, E, and a slash key of some kind. And then a bunch of things that I tracked. You know, I did a bit of digging around. They say Siemens SD80 on them, and this I believe refers to some kind of internal telecommunication system. Mm. So
yeah, I was gonna say this looks like a configuration box for like a PBX system or something.
Yeah.
Oh, or some sort of telecom, yeah, technician device or something.
That was my guess, that it was that this was purchased for the purpose of, you know, doing some kind of service on such a thing. And there's, it comes with what has to be like 40 different little brochures for this system. So maybe it was a sales unit. I don't know. The seller seems to think that the computer itself really is barely used. It looks like it looks kind of interesting, and the starting bid is $75. The shipping is free, so it's actually not very much even just for the thing in the box.
Right.
So the other extra stuff would be interesting to investigate. I think not interesting enough for me to buy it, but I will suggest it to somebody else to investigate because I think it might well be interesting. See if you can make it do something.
If you want one of these guys, this is a good one. I mean, the box looks to be in really good shape, and the machine looks flawless. It's not even dirty or faded or anything.
Yeah. So even if you're not interested in PBXs.
if you just want one of these 102s, it's pretty cool.
And this next one, I think I'm pretty sure that I've linked to one that was sort of like this before. I just find it a little bit amusing. It is a TI-99-4A. That someone has liberally applied Apple stickers to. So there's like a nice little Apple thing in the middle of the main computer, and the outline that was I guess around the Apple sticker was stuck on the power supply, and my note in the show notes was that one gets the feeling that TI-99-4A wasn't really what they wanted to buy. Yeah, you ask for a computer for Christmas, what do you want?
That is very odd. Why is there a big Apple sticker in the middle of that TI-99?
Yeah. Well, maybe the war was not as heated between the TI people and the Apple people as it was between the Commodore people and the Apple people.
It could be.
So, anyway, it seems to work. You know, it on a fuzzy TV, it produced a fuzzy picture. I'm not necessarily recommending getting this. It's not that hard to get a TI-99/4A. They do seem to be around. So you might actually want to check like local Craigslist first before having someone ship it to you from eBay. Right.
Yeah, they made a lot of them, and the nostalgia seems not as high, so they don't seem to be very expensive or hard to find.
Plus, I think these were the ones. I think they were practically giving these away at the end.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, those are the ones that. Yeah, it was down to $99 or something, and yeah, I think a lot of people bought them during that period and then used it twice and put it in the closet because right. They all seem to be in really good condition too.
Yeah.
You don't often see an abused and used up TI-99.
Okay, so the next one, I was just going through all the retro computer lists, and one that caught my attention in a way that I guess they don't usually is a big lot of PC disks. So it's just a lot of disks in a box. You know, it has XTree Pro and Turbo Pascal Tutor and Sideways and some CAD programs, DBase 3+. And I looked at this and I thought, you know, I'm not interested in this at all. and then I wonder, there must be people who are doing this. Like, this is just not a platform. There's a sense in which when I look at PC/Windows stuff, I just am overwhelmed and want to just go take a nap, you know, because it's just too much stuff. But I'm hoping that somebody's collecting this stuff and imaging it. I just don't know who they are.
I think there is some. I mean, there's definitely interest in old PCs and early Windows. I don't know if there's a community around that stuff the way there is with the other retro machines. So yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
It's funny because I feel like I don't come across them. Like if they exist, they somehow operate in a different circle. There's DOS game people, but that's not quite the same people as the ones who are archiving DBase 3+.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Early PC gamers. I use early loosely there, but yeah, sort of. Certainly, like the 90s PC gaming is a very active community. But yeah, I don't know about this stuff.
If you're listening and you know where these people are, we're curious. Email us. Okay. Anyway, there is a Sanyo VM4509 monitor, which I put in here partly just because they're usually more expensive than this, so they don't really deserve to be. They're little security monitors that became iconic by just being in photos with Apple IIs. But you know, this is if you want your original setup with your Apple II and something like this, the VM4509 is one of the ones that people used. So it's just a little box. It's black and white TV, you know, relatively sharp for what you needed to do. This one's in okay condition. It's got a starting bid of $20. You can buy it now for $55, and it would ship for like $53. And as I say, I mean it's kind of a nothing thing except for the fact that they hold this historical place. So
yeah, for listeners who might not know what we're talking about, right? This is the one that was sitting next to a stack of disk twos in like every photo of the Apple II Plus for that whole period.
Right.
Is that this one?
Yeah, it fits nicely on top of the computer. So, like, if you imagine an Apple II, you could have this on the left, and then the disk II drives, you know, sort of stacked up next to it on the right, and it sort of makes a nice, sort of similarly heighted, yeah. You know, unit.
And that setup seemed to be all of the marketing photos of it, at least in the early period.
And Apple never actually sold this monitor, but I think, you know, people who sold Apple sold these. So of course, if you want to recreate some marketing material or just, you know, have a iconic looking setup, you would want one of these. I have a couple, of course. one I actually got relatively cheaply, sort of kind of by accident. It was somebody local who had that and some other stuff. But these are just due to their iconicity. They are often expensive. So I look at a $55 price on this and I think, yeah, it's actually not bad. So if you were looking and it's still there, you know, then apparently it has 2 days left to go. So don't know if I'm going to get this edited out in time. But if you can get it at the starting bid of $20, that is actually worth it. If you wanted one in the first place, that is.
Yeah, it's a big if.
Yeah. Okay, and then the last thing I will mention is, it's partly interesting and I'm partly mocking the auction, but so this is a 1541, like a Commodore 1541 drive, except the style for the VIC-20, so it's a VIC-1541, and it's black and white. So this one, it's a starting bid of $35, and it seems all right. Shipping is quite a lot, but I think they're actually pretty heavy. Okay, so this one says floppy drive, untested, and in the description it says, has not been tested as there were no cords to be found. See my other listings for another disk drive with cords.
Wait, what?
Yeah, exactly. And the other listing is, in fact, it's the same drive, And I don't understand how somebody can type that and mean it. Anyway, so the other one costs a little bit more because it has cords and was tested.
That's very strange.
Yes. Weird. Someday I might want to have one of these drives that match the VIC-20, but I do not at the moment. My Commodore collection is fairly thin. So, okay. I think that's it for eBay. Then I guess we are already 2 hours into it or whatever we are at, ready for closing discussions. So, I don't know. Jack, do you have any closing thoughts?
Not really. The only thing I'm looking forward to next weekend, I am going to the Retro Gathering in Västerås. Mm-hmm. It's my plan. I don't know what I'll find. I don't know what I'll see, but it should be fun.
Well, you can report back.
I will.
I'll be interested to hear. Let's see. I have the only note I put in the show notes was that I'm continuing to watch the Goldbergs. I've now made it into somewhere in the middle of. I think I'm in the third season by now. I anticipate. So those who are all caught up on it probably already know where it's headed. I don't know where it's headed, but I anticipate that it's gonna lose a bit of its subtlety just because it's still going. But I actually really kind of like it. It is portraying kind of like life in the 80s growing up, at the same time that I was a kid, and I think it gets the mood fairly well occasionally. And there are occasionally retro computers in it and stuff, and not 100% of what they say is fully accurate, but it's not bad.
Yeah, it does seem like they've done their homework, at least to some degree. I've literally only watched one episode of it. Mike and I did that weird experiment on Open Apple where we did a video commentary where we expect you to watch the episode. There was one episode that was particularly Apple II heavy, and you're expected to watch that episode and listen to the podcast at the same time. I don't think it worked very well. Nobody did it. But,
I don't think I did either. I did both independently. But
yeah, it was a high barrier to entry for a mediocre experience, so I don't expect anyone to have done it. But yeah, that was my experience with it also, is that it felt like Stranger Things, but without the horror. Like, I really want to watch Stranger Things because they nail that 80s childhood feel. Mm. But you have to be able to watch a horror show to get that, which I don't want to do. So.
Yeah. I'm fairly pleased with it, at least so far. It's the show itself is kind of handled in a way that is kind of like Wonder Years. I never really watched Wonder Years that much, but it's got sort of a narrator from the present talking about what was going on in the past. Mm. And at least in these early ones, there are often actual sort of video clips from the real life events that inspired the, episode. So it's pretending to be autobiographical, Adam Goldberg. And many of these things are actually, documented on videotape from the 80s, which is kind of cool. So that's often the episodes will close with like a little clip of like the actual people doing the dumb things that were portrayed in the episode.
Yeah, it is in fact exactly the Wonder Years. I watched quite a bit of it, and yeah, the format is identical actually, but it still works because it's 80s instead of 60s.
Yeah. So we'll see how it goes when I get all caught up. There's actually already a spinoff too called Schooled, which follows one of the other characters as she goes back to become and basically the format is the same, except now it's set in the 90s and it's this person now is a music teacher in the school. So I don't know if I'll follow it, but I probably will because inertia.
Keep on rolling.
Momentum, maybe? I don't know. Something like that. So Quinn, did you have any closing thoughts you wanted to add?
Not really, just that now all this talk has made me start scheming again to do something with my F18A. Actually, I also just got my applesauce and my vidHD card. So all of those are sitting in my closet waiting for me to do something with them. All of them purchased under the philosophy of buy it while you can before it goes away forever. I may or may not ever use any of them, but I'm glad that I have them. So I'm thinking about what to do with those.
Yeah. I got the vidHD card and I tried it out on a monitor that was too weak to support it and didn't work, and then I put it back away. So, because I don't actually have any like good 1080p, you know, HDMI monitors.
Yeah, and I have lots of those, but I don't currently have an Apple II with slots here at my house. So I do own multiples of them, but they are not here at my house. So one of these days I'll try it out. But and in the meantime, I'm still working on a game for the Apple IIgs. I've gotten a lot less done on it this year than I wanted to, but hopefully I'll have an update on that at Kansas Fest this year.
Excellent. All right. I guess we made it to the end. Thanks, Quinn, for joining us.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And thanks, Jack, for joining us too.
Well, of course. My pleasure as always.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, world.
Thanks, internet.
That's right. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast, or send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com, at a link that you can find in the show notes. Please write a review on iTunes, just because. And until next time,
Retro Compute!
Damn it, thought I had.